Yeah. Once a year, right? But is a birthday, enlightenment, and death all on the same day? Yeah. I was saying last week we really missed out because the Christians get to have like two separate ones, Christmas and Easter. Right? A missed opportunity. But we do have other festivals in the year, so that's all right. Okay. Hey, everybody online, good to see you here. We have been discussing with our wonderful technology team. And hopefully we have resolved the tech issues that have been plaguing us for the last couple of weeks. But if there is any problem, then please, your patience is appreciated, and have no qualms that our dedicated IT team, aka Michael, is on it, and Venerable Cassandra, if they're here, I can't see them at the moment, so hopefully we should be good. Good. Yeah, have a look at Julian's score.
Yeah.
Very fancy. Parallel seconds, Vincent.
Yes.
Parallel seconds are pitchier. Yeah, that's nasty.
Well,
sorry. Have a look at that. The mice are really washed out. It's button is really washed out, in my opinion. Right?
I think you want to.
But maybe leave that one on for the chanting, and then put the other one on. I don't want both. It'll be less washed out. Yeah. Is that okay? Yeah. After the chanting, between the light of the chanting.
Oh, okay. Before the chanting.
No. When the chanting is finished, they turn down the light. Is that okay? All right? No, turn it on. Turn it to the. Yeah, one on. Yeah. And then turn the other one on. Yeah, that's right. That'll be okay. That's actually the opposite. That'll be all right. For now, yeah, and then turn it down. Good thing the one way isn't here, that's all I can say. Oh, not the thing. Yes, anyhow. Okay. Sorry? That is like that. Yeah. No, because I haven't listened to it yet, but it's the kind of thing that on a guitar is like really hard, parallel minor seconds, but on a piano is really easy. Yeah. Sorry, we're just discussing the musical setting for the Metta Sutta, which we are putting together with an internationally renowned concert pianist. Yes. And it's going to be sung by a Sydney renowned Buddhist singer. it's a good Nilushi.
Save the data. Hey everyone, welcome again to Friday Crow's Nest Talks. It's always so lovely and such a privilege to see you all here and to have this space where we can all just come and rest from our busy weeks and do some high-minded reflections and some meditation and have some sense of community. And it's very, very special. I just wanted to acknowledge that. So my name's Namushi, for those of you who don't know me. I help organise these talks with a team of really lovely volunteers. So thank you all for your help. So they're held every Friday. I have a mailing list. If anyone wants to be on the mailing list, just come and find me. If you have any questions throughout the day, again, come and find me at any time. There's a newbies guide, if anyone's anyone here new tonight. So you can have a look, because it's got some typical questions. You might want to drop one of those. And also just want to encourage everyone to spread the word, mention to your friends, take a flyer if you like. If you think you have no people who are interested to join. Quick announcement as well for, it's a sutta print project. So Bhante Sujato has translated the early Buddhist teachings into contemporary English. It's amazing. Like, it's, you know, a lot of the English translations are quite archaic. So it's really nice to have something that's in, you know, the language of today and translated and interpreted by a very knowledgeable monastic. So this is an amazing project. If you want to help to donate copies of the suttas, Bhante's translations to Australian institutions and temples and things, just grab one of these flyers. Please help. And you can also order a set for yourself. It's only about $300 or something, which is amazing for 28 books. So something that you might be interested in. Welcome. Yeah, I think it's like your very similar. Sorry. Some people just walk in. So I've also just, I should start with an acknowledgement of country. Just wanted to acknowledge the Indigenous custodians of the lands that we're gathering, all the Cammeraygal people. I'll just briefly say it's of particular significance this week because it's National Reconciliation Week this week. So, you know, maybe spend some time reflecting on how we can care for any Indigenous people that we know in our Indigenous communities. Yeah, so you can look at the website as well. There's events and things throughout the week. I might just introduce the speaker. So Bhante Sujato has been a monastic for about 30 years. He's given countless talks and retreats and published quite widely. So you can have a look online for his writings and his. And there are many talks on YouTube as well, if you're interested. And you can also look at suttacentral.net for the sutta translations. Bhante also was abbot of Santi Forest Monastery in Bundanoon for 10 years. It's now a nun's monastery. He trained initially in Thailand in the Thai forest tradition and under Ajahn Brahm. He's done a lot of advocacy work for social justice and things around environmental issues and female monastics as well. And he's also done a lot of interfaith events, which is, you know, particularly pertinent these days. So he's quite an extraordinary individual and a very knowledgeable Buddhist practitioner and scholar and many things, philosopher. So I think we're very, very lucky to have such a special speaker tonight. Thank you, Bhante. Welcome for the nice evening.
Thank you so very much, Bushi. All right. Let us begin by chanting some words of devotion for the Triple Gem. Does anyone need chanting sheets? Renata, have your chanting sheet. Everyone need chanting? We've got them? You got them? Okay, excellent. Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa Buddha. Sangha Gacchami Duddhiyampi Buddha Sarana Gacchami Duddhiyampi Dhamma Sarana Gacchami Duddhiyampi Sangha Sarana Gacchami Tathiyampi Buddha Gacchami Tathiyampi Gacchami Tathiyampi Sangha Sarana Gacchami Itipiso Bhagavata Sama Sambuddho Vijacharana Sampanno Sugato Kavidu Anuttaro Purisada Sarati Sattadeva Manusambhuvadavali Swakato Bhagavata Sannitiko Akaliko Ehitasiko Ananiko Pachata Vedidabu Vinyuhiti Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Nyayapatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Samijipatipanno Savakasangho Yaridanchata Ripurisayugani Abhapurisapungala Esa Bhagavato Savakasangho Abhuneyo Abhuneyo Dakyeleyo Anjanirkaraneyo Anudarabhanyaketam Ukasate Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
No, she had another way around.
Sorry.
Okay, so should we do some meditation? What do you think, Fabiana?
Yes.
It's a good idea?
Go for it.
Okay, great. So for these few weeks, we are celebrating the month of Vaisak, the birth, enlightenment, passing away of the Buddha. And in honor of that, let's do some mindfulness of breathing meditation, because that's what the Buddha himself practiced. Of course, the Buddha practiced many different kinds of meditation, but the main one that he did, it seems, was mindfulness of breathing. And I'm going to reiterate here just a few of the, going over a few of the basics of this practice to make sure that we're all well grounded in our practice of meditation. Number one, a place. So we need a place to practice, okay? You want a good place to practice? Go into the mountains and find a cave. That's number one, okay? Everything is kind of second best from there, all right? But anywhere you can find that is peaceful and you can be relatively undisturbed for a while is good enough to meditate. Number two, having a period of time to meditate in, okay? So make sure we set aside a period of time and we are clear in our minds that this is our time for meditation. During that time, if it so happens that the world ends, it is not our concern. Okay? If the building burns down, not our concern. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit here. Maybe I'm exaggerating just for effect, but you get the point that during the time of meditation, we set aside all of our concerns. This is just for meditation. Number three, we have to have a good posture to meditate in. So here in this room, most people are sitting on chairs. These chairs are fine for meditation. Actually, these are pretty good. Avoid chairs that are too comfy. Okay, I'm looking at you, all the lounge sitters. I'm inspecting everybody at home, sitting in comfy lounges. Patrick and Tanya, you're looking a bit borderline there. And Tanya, okay, but Tanya gets it. She gets an excuse because she's cuddling a cat. So that's all right. I think we can forgive her for that. Okay, so if it's too comfy, then you get too slack and you fall asleep and so on. On the other hand, if you're too tense, then that's not going to be any good either. Sitting on the floor, sitting cross-legged is the best posture if you can. But if you're not comfortable sitting on the floor, then, you know, you can do some yoga or something like that, develop your posture. Okay. Don't use like roller chairs, like office chairs. That's bad. There's no stability. Don't use like folding chairs. They're going to kind of rocking and uncertain. These ones are pretty good because they've got a solid kind of base to them. So, okay, so good posture. And we set our purpose for meditation. That means that at the beginning of the meditation that we're very clear what it is that we're doing, okay? The more that we are able to set our purpose clearly at the start of the meditation, the less we're going to have to do during the meditation to maintain that. If we sit down and start meditating without a clear purpose, we're going to get halfway through the meditation and then be like, oh, hang on, what was I doing? Oh, yeah, that's right, I was watching my breath or something. And everything gets a bit vague. Right? So at the beginning, we're very clear. We say to ourselves, you can even just repeat to yourself three times, now I will do mindfulness of breathing, now I'll do mindfulness of breathing, now I'll do mindfulness of breathing. And you can set that purpose very clearly in your mind. So these things are laying the foundation for a practice. Now, in terms of mindfulness of breathing practice itself, the key to mindfulness of breathing is that your breath is not just air. Your breath has material properties. It has emotional properties, has cognitive and psychological properties. It has spiritual properties. All of these are different dimensions of that one thing that we think of as breath. And those different properties manifest to our mind in different ways as we deepen through meditation. So it's not just like watching air coming in and out. But those different properties that the breath have make it especially suitable for meditation. Why? Because for a start, everything that happens in your mind is in one way or another mirrored in your breath. Every thought that you have, every emotion you have, every feeling you have, in some way is echoed in your breath. And when your mindfulness becomes very sharp, you can actually start to see that. But more than that, the breath has an intrinsic function, I would say biological, psychological, but also spiritual function, to bring peace. And the breath's role is to soothe you. It's doing that right now. It's calming you down. And when we proceed with the mindfulness of breathing meditation, the more that we pay attention to the breath, the more the breath will calm us down. And the calmer that we become, then the calmer the breath will become. Because the more that the breath calms us down, the less tension we have in our body, the less oxygen that we need, the less oxygen our brain is consuming. And because of all those things, then the breath becomes calmer, then our mind and body become calmer, and then that becomes a virtuous cycle. That's how the meditation works, that there's this, the breath works with the mind and the body to bring us to peace. What that implies is that if we approach the meditation saying, I'm going to do this meditation to make myself become peaceful, right, then you're starting to wrestle with your own mind. You're already assuming, right, the back of your mind is an assumption that I'm not peaceful. You see? Oh, I'm going to do this so that I become peaceful. I'm going to reach this state, which is not where I'm at now. But that's not true. Actually, you are peaceful already. A lot of skeptics in the audience tonight, I see. You are peaceful already. Or let me rephrase that. That there is peace in you. That there is part of you that is peaceful. That between one thought and the next, for example, there is peace. Maybe not long-lasting, okay? It might be as peaceful as a ceasefire in Gaza or something like that, you know? But, sorry, that was a bit of a slightly off-colour joke. I'm sorry. But still there is something, right? There is an ease of a time between the mind tensing and straining and hurting itself. There is that time of peace, and that those times of peace are what keep us sane. That's why we are not totally caught up in our thoughts and feelings and desires all the time, because we have those moments of peace and yet we don't notice it. So when we meditate, it's not that we are making our mind peaceful. It is that we are engaging with that process that is already bringing peace to us, and we are allowing that same process to come to ripeness and fullness, all right? So that's how meditation works. It's not about us imposing our will on our mind. It's about us relinquishing our will. Vosagga ramanam karitva labhati samadhin labhati citta saikagata. Based on letting go, the mind attains oneness, the mind attains stillness. That's a quote from the suttas. So through letting go, the breath is able to do its job of calming us down. So that means that from the start, once we've set our purpose in the meditation, that we should be doing the minimum necessary to keep our awareness with our breathing. Rather than focusing too hard, of course you have to focus a bit on your breathing, right? You have to direct your mind in that way. But you do that as gently as possible. And when we are paying attention to our breathing, one of the keys to that, to letting the breath calm us down, is that once we put our mind on the breathing, okay, we are aware of it, then we pull our mind back from it a little bit. You're almost like you pull your mind back from it and let the breathing come to you. Yeah? Once you feel that you're aware of your breathing, like you've focused your mind on your breathing, then pull your focus back a little bit, let the breathing come to you. And when you can let the breath come to you, then the mind will start to become peaceful. If you can sustain that perfect quality of touch in your meditation, you will find that the meditation becomes peaceful very quickly. It doesn't take hours, it takes minutes, even seconds. You can feel that, when you get that just that right attention, that right quality of attention, then you'll notice the mind will become peaceful right away. Yeah. That's what makes the difference in meditation, is the quality of mindfulness, the quality of attention that you bring to it, not the amount of hours you spend doing it, not the amount of, the particular technique or anything like that. Those things don't matter too much. What matters is the quality of attention you bring to the meditation. Okay, let's do some practice. sitting quietly. Letting the mind settle inside your body. Now bring awareness to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And when your mind runs off thinking about this and that, just be aware of it, okay? That's what I'm thinking about. And then come back. Let your breath calm you down. Let your breath bring you peace. Let your breath soothe you. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. As you feel the mind becoming more peaceful, your body becoming more peaceful, notice how the breath brings with it a subtle sense of joy or a subtle light or a soft sense of ease. There's something nice about it. The quality it has that's soothing. So now coming near to the end of the meditation, I want you to let your awareness come back into the sounds around you. And before we finish, take a minute to reflect back over the meditation, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself what just happened. Ask yourself, how was my mind When we began that meditation, what kinds of things was I thinking of? How did my body feel as I was sitting here in meditation? And how did my breath feel? And then as we proceeded through the meditation, how did that change? How did my breath change? And how does my breath feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? So if you reflect like this at the end of each meditation, that's how we learn wisdom. That's how we learn to understand our own practice. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. May all beings find Nibbana. So, just also, is it? Okay, everybody, let's have a break. Grab a cup of tea. Come back for some Dhamma talk. So, Leah has asked about there's a loud clock noise and something, dog barking. I can't hear that here. So, anybody else getting that problem? You also hearing it? Michael, a few others are hearing it. The clock is always loud. Is that the clock in here, in this room? It's the clock in this room, is it really? You guys can hear the clock in this room. Wow, okay. What can I say? Right. Dogs? Do we have dogs? No. Okay, I do apologize for that. But people are hearing clocks loudly in the background. Okay, there you go. What can I say? Okay, sorry about that. Anyway. All right, we'll be back in a few minutes. People online are saying that there's a really loud clock noise.
Yes. It's on. It's very quiet.
I can't hear it at all.
Yeah.
Okay, fine, everybody. We can put it outside during meditation, banish it. Anyway.
During the meditation,
yeah. Right, it's weird, isn't it? Right, I mean, it shows you how your perception changes, right, and how, like, what happens when you meditate, when your ears close down. This is something that musicians know. So just like if you're in a dark room, you go into the bright sunlight, then your eyes are, you know, hurt, and then you get used to it. But when you're in a very dark place, you can actually see almost nothing. Almost just the tiniest scrap of light you can see. But your ears do the same thing, but it's not so obvious, so you don't really notice it. So if for musicians, one of the tricks musicians use, if people are not paying attention, then you play quieter. And then people have to lean forward to listen. If you're too loud, then people shut their ears down. Yeah. So not all musicians do that, obviously. If you're playing heavy metal, you don't do that. Just if people aren't listening, you just take it up to 11 and then they'll listen. Sorry? Okay.
If you whisper, they...
Right. Works for parents as well, according to Fabioli. Yell at the children, they go. If you whisper, then they lean forward. Yeah. So, okay. So for today, we are still in the Waysak, we're just at the end of the Waysak month. And during this time, I usually give a few talks on different aspects of the Buddha's life. So each year, I try to do something that's a bit different and to try to talk about the Buddha's life in a way that is practical and meaningful. Actually, somebody like the Buddha, whose life and teachings and practice and realization has been so meaningful to so many people over such a long time, then we can find so many aspects of his life to talk about. Now, of course, my own practice and study comes primarily from the early Buddhist texts, so I usually try to focus on things that are found from the early texts rather than things from sort of later legends and so on and so forth. And what I find personally is that when we look at how the Buddha was from those early texts, we find a person who was much more relatable and who brought, and what's really crucial to me is that he not only realized these incredible truths and this incredible transcendence and transformation, but he also was able to bring that into people's lives in a very practical way. Last week when I spoke, I talked about how after the Buddha's enlightenment, he then established the Sangha, established the Buddhist communities and the fourfold Sangha, or bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, lay men and lay women, or the universal Sangha as we can also translate it. And so that establishing this universal Sangha was his first task after he's enlightened. In a way, like it took him 6 years to get enlightened and then like 45 years to establish the community. So that was most of his life's work. And this is something which is not everybody can do. So there are plenty of people who are spiritually enlightened or progressed or whatever, but who don't know how to translate that into a community, or who know how to build communities but aren't enlightened. One way or the other, these things happen fairly commonly. But to have them both is very rare. So what I thought for today, last time we looked at part of the text that talks about the establishment of the Sangha. So I thought today we might continue with that text. It's quite a long passage, and as before, I won't go through the whole thing, but just select a few highlights. So this is from the first chapter of what we call the Khandakas, which is the portion of the Vinaya that deals with Sangha procedures and so on. And particularly, this first chapter deals with ordination. And we already looked about how the Buddha, after his enlightenment, sought out some students, taught them, and then gradually ordained them. So they became also bhikkhus, became mendicants following him. And we saw that the first generation, the Buddha would just say, "Ehi bhikkhu, come." And then they were ordained. Then he taught the monks that they could do three refuges. And by taking three refuges, then that was the first kind of ordination. And we noticed how the Buddha, right from the beginning, was intent on decentralizing the Sangha, not on monopolizing everything through him as a teacher. And the Buddha is the source of the authority and the source of the teaching. We all know this. But he wanted the Sangha to be able to teach, to be able to gain students, to be able to teach their own students, and to be able to spread. And that was the foundation of the resilience that Buddhism has had till the present day. You can see today a lot of spiritual movements, they're very cultish, depending on one individual. And when you have that, that tells us two things. When you have a movement that's very dependent on one individual, first of all, it tells you that that individual is lacking something, that they need that support. They're looking for students because they want to be the one on top. And that speaks to a certain inadequacy within their own spiritual development. That's number one. And number two, any movement like that is going to be brittle. When the teacher dies, it'll all fall apart. Happens all the time. This is one of the reasons why Buddhism didn't fall apart. And you can look at Buddhism now, right? Look, if we want to look at Buddhism now in different Buddhist countries, if there's people here from Indonesia, from Sri Lanka, from Malaysia, from different Buddhist countries. Now, if I was to talk to any of them, they could all sit down and tell me everything that's wrong about Buddhism in their own country, right? Am I wrong? No, I'm not wrong. And they wouldn't be wrong, because there's a lot wrong with Buddhism in all these different countries, right? But it's 2,500 years, yeah? It's not perfect, and lots of things have gone wrong, and lots of things should be reformed, absolutely, and I've tried to do what little I can to do that. But the fact that it still exists is incredible. The fact that there's still something worthwhile about it, that there's still a recognition of what it can be. Like if we say that it shouldn't be this, and implicit in that is the idea that it could be something better. And I think for all of us, like we have this aspiration that we feel moved and inspired by the purity and integrity of the Buddha's teachings. So of course it's disappointing when others don't live up to that. It's disappointing when we don't live up to that. But still, there is something that is calling us to live up to the Buddha's example. So in these teachings in the Khandakas, what we're seeing is how the Buddha applied these very lofty spiritual ideals to the practical day-to-day exercise of running a community. That's really crucial. Let's read a few more passages and we will see what we've learned. We've gone up to, last week we went up to the point when the Buddha had the last thing, he was in Rajagaha and he had allowed monasteries, right? So arguably the beginning of the ending for Buddhism, when you allow monasteries, that means you have property, that means you have money, that means you have repair bills, sorry, corruption, plumbing, all of those things, right? Okay, so after all that is the account of the going forth of Sariputta and Moggallana. Okay, who can tell me who are Sariputta and Moggallana? Buddha's disciples. What? Which one? How? In if we were to rank the Buddha's disciples, where would they be?
Oh,
the top. Yes, that's right. Because the Buddha was all about ranking people. Okay, fine. Okay. The top 10 monks. Okay. Now, at that time, the wanderer Sanjaya was staying in Rajagaha with a large group of 250 wanderers, including Sariputta and Moggallana. So the wanderer Sanjaya is a figure who appears elsewhere in the suttas, and his main teaching seems to have been the teaching that I don't say it is, I don't say it is not, I don't say it both is and is not, and I don't say it neither is nor is not. I don't not say that it is, and I don't not say that it is not, and I don't neither say that it is and it is not. He would have had a wonderful career in our modern philosophy department. Hi to any philosophers out there. We love you. Okay. So Sariputra Moggallana, the two of them made an agreement that whoever reached freedom from death first would inform the other. So it seems that they were living under this teacher, but they were under no illusions that the teacher himself was enlightened. Just then, Venerable Asaji, robed up in the morning, took his bowl and robe and entered Rajagaha for alms food. So Asaji was one of the first group of disciples, a group of five mendicants who he's already seen became enlightened. He was pleasing in his conduct, in going out and coming back and looking ahead and looking aside and bending and stretching his arms. His eyes were lowered and he was perfect in deportment. The wanderer Sariputta observed all this and thought, this monk is one of those in the world who are perfected or on the path to perfection. Why don't I go up to him and ask in whose name he has gone forth and who his teacher is or whose teaching he follows? But it occurred to him, it's the wrong time to ask him while he's walking for alms food among the houses. Let me follow behind him. for one who seeks the path will find it. After wandering for alms in Rajagaha, Asaji turned back with his alm food. Sariputta then went up to him, exchanged pleasantries with him. And he asked, Venerable, your senses are clear and your skin is pure and bright. In whose name have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? And he said, There's a great ascetic, a Sakyan, who has gone forth from the Sakyan clan. I've gone forth in his name. He is my teacher and I follow his teaching. But what does he teach? And Asaji said, I've only recently gone forth. I'm new to this spiritual path. I'm not able to give you the teaching in full, but I can tell you the meaning in brief. Sariputta replied, Yes, please. And he added, Speak little or much, but do tell me the meaning. I just want the meaning. For what's the point of a detailed exposition? Okay, first of all, I'm just going to say this is really out of character for Sariputta, because he gave a lot of the most detailed expositions. So maybe he changed his mind about that later on, whatever. So Asaji gave this teaching to the wanderer Sariputta. Of causally arisen things, the Buddha has declared their cause as well as their ending. This is the teaching of the great ascetic. And so this particular verse is a very famous one in Buddhism, and it announces that the core of the Buddha's teaching is the teaching on conditionality, teaching on dependent origination. And this verse is inscribed across India for like 1,000 years. Most of the stupas, Buddha images, anything like that, they will always include this verse on it, one of the most famous verses in Buddhism. When he heard this teaching, Sariputra experienced the stainless vision of the truth. Anything that has a beginning has an end. Now, this is the truth, even just this much, the sorrowless state that you have penetrated unseen and neglected for innumerable eons. Then the wanderer Sariputta went to the wanderer Moggallana. Moggallana saw him coming, said, Friend, your senses are clear and your skin is pure and bright. You haven't attained freedom from death, have you? He said, I have. Wasn't just a new skincare regime. You've either got enlightened or you found a really good TikTok for doing your skincare. How did it happen? I'm sorry, okay. Sariputta told him everything up to and including the teaching given by Asaji. Then Sariputta too experienced the stainless vision of the truth. That means he became a stream entrant. Moggallana said to Sariputta, let's go to the Buddha, he's our teacher. Then Sariputta said, but these 250 wanderers look to us for support. We must tell them first so they can take appropriate action. They went to the wanderers and they told him that they were going to see the Buddha. They said, if you were to practice a spiritual life under the great ascetic, so will all of us. Then Sariputra Moggallana went to Sanjaya and said, we're going to the Buddha, he's our teacher. Sanjaya said, don't go, the three of us can look after this community together. But they said the same thing two or three times and got the same result. Then they took the 250 wanderers and went to the bamboo grove, but the wanderer Sanjaya vomited hot blood right there. When the Buddha saw Sariputra Moggallana coming, he said to the monks, the two friends, Kolita and Upatissa, are coming. They will become my most eminent disciples, an excellent pair. So Kolita and Upatissa are their personal names. They'd not even reached the bamboo grove, yet had a profound range of knowledge about the supreme end of ownership, about freedom. And the teacher said of them, these two friends are coming, Kolita and Upatissa. They will be an excellent pair, my most eminent disciples. So that last bit I just read out is two verses. And I just want to make a brief remark about this. So this passage in the Khandakas, we find this is a literary feature where a prose passage is then summed up with some verses. And it's quite a peculiar kind of literary feature of this particular particular piece of text. The verses were added later, and they give a indication of the fact that this whole sequence, this whole text, evolved and grew over a long period of time, and that's there are many indications of that. So this isn't something that was just like written all at once, but the basic skeleton and the basic framework was greatly expanded over many years. All right, so the Buddha accepted and those great disciples, and then... before I go on, are there any questions about that? Sariputra Moggallana, before we proceed. Yes.
might be a random question. Do you
Please.
Think that Sanjaya was vomiting blood?
Do I think Sanjaya was vomiting blood?
Did you say that?
Did I say that? Yeah, he vomited hot blood. Okay. I mean, it's an idiom. I'm not entirely sure if it just meant that he was like, you know, whether it was just an expression or meant that he was like really very perturbed. Obviously, it means that he was very perturbed by events. Whether basically, right? Exactly. Yeah, he was spewing. Maybe he is Australian, I don't know. Okay? Just to clarify, yes, you did hear that correctly, yes. The TikTok bit. No, but it is a good hint if you want to set up your own cult. Right? Make makeup. You can make yourself look like you're enlightened. Note to self, right? So for anyone who's wanting to set up their own cult. Any sensible questions? No, they're all good questions. Okay, we're all good? Okay, so Sariputta and Moggallana, of course, feature widely throughout the suttas. We meet them many different times, and they were stalwarts of the Buddhist community for all those years. Both of them passed away shortly before the Buddha did.
They're both slightly older.
Sorry?
They're both slightly older.
Slightly older than the Buddha, I'm not sure.
That was
94. Maybe. I don't think his age is specified in the early suttas, but yeah, I'm not sure. Roughly same generation, I think, yeah. So Venerable Pasanna, that is a cursed word that you've put in that chat, and I'm not going to say it. Okay. Okay. Right. I'm going to proceed now. Next, at that time, the monks did not have preceptors or teachers, and as a result, they were not being instructed. Okay, so let's notice first of all that thing, that the ordination was introduced, right, but there wasn't any mechanism to supply mentorship for the new students, right? When walking for alms round, they were shabbily dressed and improper in appearance. People were eating. While people were eating, they held out their alms bowls to receive leftovers, even right over their food. Can you imagine? You're just sitting there like at a cafe in Parramatta, and then I walk up to you and I just put my bowl right on top of your food. That's not going to happen. Right over their food, whether it's cooked or fresh fruit, delicacy or drinks. They ate bean curry and rice that they themselves had asked for, and they were noisy in the dining hall. People complained and criticized them. How can the Sakya monastics act like this? They're just like Brahmins at a Brahmanical meal. Oh dear, bit of religious shade being served there. The monks heard the complaints of those people, the monks of few desires who had a sense of conscience and were contented, afraid of wrongdoing and fond of the training, complained and criticized them. How can those monks act like this? They told the Buddha. Soon afterwards, the Buddha had the Sangha gathered and questioned the monks. Is it true, monks, that monks act like this? It is true, sir. The Buddha rebuked them. It is not suitable for those foolish men. It is not proper. It is not worthy of a monastic. It's not allowable. It's not to be done. How can they act like this? This will affect people's confidence and cause some to lose it. Then the Buddha spoke in many ways in dispraise of being difficult to support and maintain, in dispraise of great desires, discontent, socializing and laziness, but he spoke many ways in praise of being easy to support and maintain, of fewness of wishes, contentment, self-effacement, ascetic practice, serenity, reduction in things and being energetic. And so this is a standard passage about how issues were brought to the Buddha. Okay, so I just want to break this down a little bit. So this is one of those tropes which is repeated throughout the Vinaya, usually abbreviated. But first of all, the people hear about the problems, in this case it's the monks, but it might also be the lay people or something, then they start complaining about it. Okay, often one finds in modern Buddhism that people seem to think that it's wrong to complain, okay? But that's not what the Buddha was saying here. You can see because when the complaints were made, the Buddha said, is that justified, right? So he gathered people together and asked, is it true? Yeah, this is the Buddha's procedure. He doesn't just believe rumors, right? He gets to the facts, and then he acts on the basis of those facts. This is really key to think about how this works when you're establishing a community, okay? If you're a leader of a community, by which I mean leader of a family, leader of a club, leader of a group at your workplace, then you're setting an example for the behavior of everybody else. If somebody brings a complaint and you reject that complaint out of hand and say, stop being a complainer, blah, 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 right, then people aren't going to feel heard. And you're setting up an environment where abusive practices can then continue, right, and nobody can feel that they can do anything about it. Now, in this particular case, there's nothing actually abusive going on, right? These guys are just a bit, didn't really know what they were doing. They did not doing anything particularly harmful. But still, the Buddha heard the complaints and he took them seriously. He didn't dismiss the complainers. This is really important. But at the same time, he can't just believe the complainers because of what they say. So you bring people together and in public, right, not saying, oh, we can't affect the reputation of Buddhism, we have to hide this away and do this in private, right? No. Get everyone around, say, is this true? And people have to respond and say, is this true or not? And if it is true, then you take appropriate action. So the Buddha was very straightforward to criticize that behavior. This is not to be done. And he gives the reasons for doing that, right? And so the reasons are the values and the principles which the Sangha should be applying. So he's explaining the reasons why this should be happening and then giving a solution, okay? So the solution is, after giving a teaching, he then said there should be a preceptor, okay, an upajaya. So Venerable Brahmali has translated upajaya as preceptor. That's a kind of classical translation of upajaya. I prefer the translation mentor. Which I'll go into in just a second. But I just want to just rest on that for a moment and just recollect that process that the Buddha is using for solving problems. And that process shows respect to every single person in the community, right? That's how you build a community. That's why the Sangha is so resilient, because the Buddha treated everybody with respect and decency. In some cases, maybe he'd ask that and then find out it wasn't true. Then he would reject it. That happens. But if it is true, then he acts accordingly. That's leadership. So then he says there should be a upajaya. Right? Upajaya, the word, is a preceptor. And an upajaya is somebody who, when you ordain, is basically your mentor for life. Right? It's not a temporary position. It means as long as you're ordained, then that upajaya is your mentor, looks after them. Translated here as preceptor, I don't really like the word preceptor because it conveys the impression that the upajaya performs the ordination. This is what people these days think. A preceptor is one who gives the precepts, but that's not what an upajaya does. It is the sangha that performs the ordination, not the upajaya. This is really crucial, widely misunderstood in Buddhism today. In fact, throughout Thailand, this is why they said we couldn't do bhikkhuni ordination, because no upajaya would do the ordination. This is what they told us. Yeah? But the upajaya is not the one who does the ordination. It's the sangha that does the ordination. The upajaya's role is to be a mentor. And most of the time in the modern sangha, the upajaya doesn't actually perform that role. They perform the role as a functionary whose job is to rubber stamp the ordination, to make sure that the legalities are observed, that people are registered and their names are written down and so on and so forth. And that's really all they do. And they don't actually act in that spiritual mentorship role anymore. which I think is really unfortunate. And there's a long history behind that, but one of the reasons behind that, certainly in Thailand, is because of the state's desire to control the Sangha. So the state appoints the Upajaya. So this is what the Buddha said about the Upajaya, or the preceptor, or as Venerable Brahmali has, or mentor, as I would say. The mentor should think of his student as a son, and his student, his preceptor, his mentor, as a father. In this way, they will respect, esteem, and be considerate towards each other, and they will grow and reach greatness on the spiritual path. And we talked about this briefly last week, but just, of course, with the bhikkhunis, then they have a similar role. In the bhikkhunis, it's called a pavattini, but in this case, it's being phrased from the monk's perspective. So a preceptor should be chosen like this after arranging his upper robe over one shoulder. A student should pay respect at the feet of the potential preceptor. He should squat on his heels, raise his joint palms and say, "Venerable, please be my preceptor." He should repeat this a second and third time. If the other conveys the following by body or speech, "Yes, no problem, it's suitable, it's appropriate," or "carry on with inspiration," then a preceptor has been chosen. So that also is an interesting detail, right? It's a student that chooses the preceptor, right? You see how the Buddha does these things, right? You're applying for a job at a company, right? The company then says, this is going to be your boss, who's going to be looking after you, right? Do you apply for a job at a company and then say, well, like, actually, I prefer to work with this person, right? Right? Because the student needs to set up a relationship of trust with a person whose responsibility is to look after them. It's so the way the venue is set up is so radical in so many ways. I honestly feel like we're not even vaguely catching up to how radical the venue is, even in the Sangha. Okay, moving along. A student should conduct himself properly towards his preceptor. This is the proper conduct. Now, look, I'm not going to be able to go through all this. You can see that there's a few pages of this proper conduct of the student for the teacher. I'm just going to read a little bit, but this is a really interesting passage, and it's one of the fundamental passages that governs the relationship of students and teacher within the Sangha. And in practice communities, we still follow all of these things. Having gotten up at the appropriate time, as appropriate, not all of them apply, but we follow these things as best as possible. Having gotten up at the appropriate time, the student should remove his sandals, arrange his upper robe over one shoulder. He should then give his preceptor a tooth cleaner and water for rinsing his mouth, and he should prepare a seat for him. If there is konjac, as porridge, he should rinse a vessel and bring the porridge to his preceptor. So this is talking about in the early morning before going on alms round. When he's drunk the konjac, the student should give him water, receive the vessel, holding it low. He should wash it carefully without scratching it and then put it away. When the preceptor has gotten up, the student should put away the seat. If the place is dirty, he should sweep it. If the preceptor wants to enter the village for alms round, the student should give him a sarong and receive the one he's wearing in return, that is the lower robe. Right? So this is implying that they have more than one lower robe. He should give him a belt. He should put the upper robes together, overlapping each other edge to edge, and give them to him. This refers, I won't go into detail, but this refers to the manner of wearing the robes on alms round. He should rinse the preceptor's bowl and give it to him while wet. If the preceptor wants an attendant, the student should put on his sarong evenly all around, covering the navel and the knees. He should put on a belt, putting the upper robes together. He should rinse his bowl, bring it along, and be the preceptor's attendant. He should not walk too far behind his preceptor or too close. He should receive the contents of his bowl. He shouldn't interrupt his preceptor when he's speaking. But if the preceptor's speech is bordering on an offense, he should stop him. Okay? So this is an interesting detail, right? You're going into town with your preceptor. Your preceptor's speech is bordering on offense. Then you should stop him. Okay? The student's responsibility is to stop the preceptor. What would be speech bordering on offense?
Lies.
Sorry?
Lies.
Lies such as?
That's not true.
Right? Okay, it's a lie to speak. Sorry. Thank you for that, Sintin. No, thank you. Okay, so for example, if the preceptor... right? Perhaps that might be one, hey, it's okay to give us money. Or you might say, a precept might say, oh, you know, I had such great meditation today. My mind's really pure. If you give me lots more stuff, then you'll make lots more merit. These kinds of things. Or another example, if the preceptor's speech is getting a bit flirty, right? Or offensive, right? Yeah, maybe like yelling at people or abusing them and so on, then definitely could be bordering on an offense. But then interesting, right, the student's responsibility. It doesn't just say that the student can stop the preceptor. It's the student's responsibility to do that. It's a mutual relationship. When returning, the student should first go to prepare a seat, set out a footstool, a foot scraper, and water for washing the feet. He should go out to meet the preceptor, receive his bowl and robe. He should give him a sarong, receive the one he's wearing in return. If the robe is damp, he should sun it for a short while, but he shouldn't leave it in the heat. So this we still do in Wadnanachat and other places. When you're going out walking like that in the day, often you sweat a lot. And so your robes get sweaty. So this is why you swap over the robes and then sun the old one so it dries out. Then he should fold the robe, offsetting the edges by 7 centimetres so the fold doesn't become worn. He should place the belt in the fold. So all of these details we still follow. If there is alms food and the preceptor wants to eat, the student should give him water and then alms food. He should ask the preceptor if he wants water to drink when the preceptor's eaten. The student should give him water, receive his bowl, holding it low. He should wash it carefully without scratching it, then dry it and sun it for a short while, but he shouldn't leave it in the heat. The student should put away the robe and bowl. When putting away the bowl, he should hold the bowl in one hand, feel under the bench or the bed with the other, and then put it away. There's no snakes under there. He shouldn't put the bowl away on this bare floor. When putting away the robe, he should hold the robe with one hand, wipe the bamboo robe rack or clothesline with the other, and then put it away by folding the robe over it, making the ends face the wall and the fold face out. Right? When the preceptor has gotten up. Sorry? Right? When the preceptor has gotten up, students should put away. So each one has a meaning, right? So that particular one means that when you put the robe away, you don't, you're not pulling on the robe and you're not straining it. Right? You put it away in a way that it's just placed over the thing it's hanging on. When the preceptor has gotten up, the student should put away the seat and also the footstool, the foot scrape, and the water washing the feet. If the place is dirty, he should sweep it. So that's the meal and alms round. And there's similar sections for different aspects of monastic life, and I won't go through all of those. But I'll come on a little bit further to a section on spiritual support. So this also is very interesting. If the preceptor becomes discontent with the spiritual life, the student should send him away, or have him sent away, or should give him a teaching, okay? Depending on the particular situation. They might become discontented with the spiritual life because of the place that they're staying at. For example, they might have too many responsibilities, right? And they're burdened with teaching and so on and so forth, getting down, getting depressed, and the student might say, look, go away. Go and have a retreat or go somewhere else and get the support you need. So sometimes that's an appropriate response. If the preceptor becomes anxious, the student should dispel it or have it dispelled or should give him a teaching. If the preceptor has a wrong view, the student should make him give it up or have someone else do it. If the preceptor has committed a heavy offence and deserves probation, the student should try to get the Sangha to give it to him. If the preceptor has committed, and there are various details about heavy offences, which I won't go into, more legalistic. So this is not saying that preceptors are perfect. And it's not saying that you should just worship them like a guru and never question anything they say. The student has a responsibility to look after the preceptor. If the Sangha wants to do a legal procedure against the preceptor, the student should make an effort to stop it or reduce the penalty, right? So if the preceptor deserves a legal process, then the student should bring that about. But if the Sangha is bringing it to the preceptor, it's the student's duty to stand on the preceptor's side, right? Doesn't mean like against the Sangha or against the Vinaya, but it means like sticking up for them within the bounds of the Vinaya. If the Sangha has already done a legal procedure, the student should help the preceptor conduct himself properly and suitably so as to deserve to be released from that penalty and try to get the Sangha to lift that procedure. So this is one of the things. You can see how this is a really beautiful way to run a community. Because in this case, if someone's genuinely done something wrong, the Sangha gets together and says, no, you've done this wrong, you need to rehabilitate yourself. But that person who's done something wrong is not cast aside. They are not alone. They still have people who will be with them and who will stick up with them. They're not denying that they did something wrong, but they'll have people who will be trying to work to rehabilitate them. Again, this is how the community is built to be resilient. And there's various other things there which I won't go into. Now, then we have a discussion of the proper conduct of the preceptor to the student. Preceptor should conduct himself properly to the student. Preceptor should help and take care of his student through recitation, questioning, and instruction. Okay, so that's number one thing, is education. So this is, so a preceptor should take personal attention to looking at education of the student. If the preceptor has a bowl but not the student, the preceptor should give it to him or make an effort to get him one. Okay? Preceptor's responsibility is to give his own bowl to the student if the student is lacking a bowl. If the preceptor has a robe but not the student, the preceptor should give it to him or make an effort to get him one. Or if the preceptor has any other kind of requisite, it's the preceptor's job to make sure that the student has them. So as you can see here, that this is why I was saying this is a role of mentorship. It's a role of looking after people, not just a role of performing a ritual at the ordination itself. Okay, then it goes on. If the student is sick, the preceptor should get up at the appropriate time and give his student a tooth cleaner and water for rinsing the mouth, and he should prepare a seat for him. If there is conge, he should rinse a vessel and bring the conge to his student. When he's drunk the conge, the preceptor should give him water and receive the vessel, and so on. So all of those duties that we just saw for the student to the preceptor are also the duties for the preceptor to the student. Yeah? In at the right time, right? So especially if the student is unable to do them, right? Again, it's very radical, isn't it? Just think about what that means, right? That it's if you're in a monastery, the senior most monk's responsibility, if they're the preceptor, is to get up in the morning and bring porridge for their student is sick and needs it. Yeah? And that responsibility stays with you your whole life. It doesn't go away. It's not like there's a set period and then it finishes. It's with you your whole life. So this is something which, again, we observe in Vinaya observant monasteries. Like if you go back and stay in a monastery where your upajara is staying, then all of these duties sort of reactivate. Like if you go somewhere else, obviously you can't do that. But if you then come back, then all of those duties will like reactivate, as it were, and you'll still have that same responsibility to your preceptor and your preceptor to you. Okay, so that's, I won't go through all of that, but that's really worth reading, and all of those are fundamental behaviours for monastics. Okay, next we have a section which talks about asking forgiveness. Again, without going into all of the details, if preceptor and student do something wrong, they should ask for forgiveness. And when the preceptors were asked for forgiveness, they did not forgive. They told the Buddha, and the Buddha said, you should forgive. They still do not forgive. So when so this is one thing which is still very much a part of Buddhism. When you do something wrong, you ask for forgiveness. Okay? Your responsibility to do that, the person who's done something wrong, you should ask for forgiveness. And the person who has asked for forgiveness should give that forgiveness, okay? Assuming that the person is sincere, right? If the person's not sincere, that's a different matter. But if they're sincere, then you should grant them forgiveness, all right? Okay, so that's where that comes from. So you can see that all of these different details are here. All right. The Buddha then gives an example. There's a story here, gives an example of this Brahmin who ordained. He became thin and unwell. He wanted to ordain and the monks declined and he became unwell. The Buddha said, "Does anyone remember any act of service from that Brahmin?" Venerable Sariputta replied, "I do, sir. What service do you remember, Sariputta? When I was walking for alms food here in Rajagaha, that Brahmin gave a ladle full of food." "Good, good, Sariputta. True people have gratitude. Well then, Sariputta, give that Brahmin the going forth and full ordination." "But how should I do it?" The Buddha then gave a teaching and then established the full ordination procedure. So obviously, for whatever reason, nobody liked that old Brahmin. No one would give him the ordination. But just the memory of one good deed that he had done was enough for the Buddha to say, no, he deserves the ordination. He saw that he had that potential. Now, we saw last time that the Buddha began with the Kam Bhikkhu ordination and then the Three Refuges ordination. And now we're introducing the ordination through a legal procedure of one emotion and three announcements, okay, Nyati Chatuttakamma. And that's how ordination is still done today, okay? So it's a formal legal procedure. That means you have to have a sangha of at least five bhikkhus to do this procedure. And it goes through the ordination procedure. "Please, venerables, I ask the sangha to listen. So-and-so wants the full ordination with venerable so-and-so. If the sangha is ready, it should give the ordination to so-and-so with so-and-so as a preceptor. This is the motion." And it's repeated then three times. "The sangha has given the full ordination to so-and-so with so-and-so as his preceptor. The sangha approves and is therefore silent. I will remember it thus." So that's how the ordination procedure is done. And it's very clear, as I mentioned before, that it is the sangha who performs the ordination. And so the sangha in that case means the sangha that is gathered within that one monastic boundary for that occasion. Okay. So then there goes to various kinds of problems that arise with the ordination procedure. On one occasion, a monk misbehaved immediately after his full ordination. The monks told him, "Don't do that. It's not allowable." And the monk said, "But I didn't ask you to ordain me. Why did you ordain me without being asked?" Fair enough. So I told the Buddha, he said, "You shouldn't give full ordination to someone who hasn't asked." Fair enough. So then it gives the gives a procedure for asking for ordination. And I might leave it for there and just see if there's any questions. The passage then goes on to talk about a lot of other things, such as things that are going to rule out qualifications for ordination, different requirements for the preceptor and the teacher, and various details that would render the ordination invalid and so on. So, of course, over time, things get more complicated, but the basic principles and the basic methods that we've seen are still used by the Buddha throughout. That is to say, he would always consult with the Sangha, he would always listen when people made a complaint, he'd always find what is the truth of the matter, and then he would make a ruling that would be applicable to the Sangha in general. So, any questions about that? Yeah, Nina.
Do you think
the
Buddha intended some of these things to be like a model for hierarchical relationships in contexts that didn't involve monastics, like for lay?
Okay, so do I think that the Buddha intended this as a model for hierarchical relationships also for lay people? Yes, and both also. Like Sanjaya, I'm going to say. Because one thing, in setting up the constitution, the Buddha was drawing from procedures that were followed in his culture, right? So we don't have all of those details, like in terms of how they were doing things, but certainly there was an influence about what was being done in the culture. So, I'm assuming that it's not exactly the same, but there was certainly something similar. Then you mentioned about hierarchical relationships, and the Sangha's relationship to hierarchy is again, is I think one of these things that's widely misunderstood. So within the Sangha, there's no power of command. Okay, so this is one of the normal features of hierarchy. If in a hierarchy, somebody who's above somebody else gets to tell them what to do, right? You guys all work in organizations, most of you, right? Is that how it works? You've got a boss, the boss tells you what to do, and you have to do what the boss says, yeah? So Sangha isn't set up like that. And there's no vow of obedience. Like you go through that ordination ceremony, there's not, like the Christians have a vow of obedience, we don't have a vow of obedience, right? And on the contrary, we've seen there that the student should question the teacher, and there are other cases goes through and it says that the student should disobey the teacher. Specifically, if the teacher's saying to do something that's against the Dhamma and Vinaya, then the student should not follow it. So, of course, on the other hand, there is an expectation of respect for seniority, right? So the mentor-student relationship does set up a relationship of respect, you know, teacher-student relationship. But that's not enforced through power. So the power rests with the Sangha as a whole, right? Power rests with Sangha as a whole, and it's the Sangha that appoints the preceptor. And so the student can ask for the preceptor, right? But the Sangha has to then accept it and then appoint the preceptor. So the power actually rests with the community, acting in accordance with the Vinaya. And so outside of that, there's relationships of respect, but not relationships of power. Yeah, if you want to describe that as hierarchical, you can, but it's not normally how we think about that. Yeah. It's a really crucial feature of the Sangha, and it's one of those things where I think if you lose that relationship of respect, then you've lost something crucial. And if you turn that relationship of respect into a relationship of power, you've also lost something crucial. Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, Nilushi had a hand up first. Yeah. Nilushi, go.
It sounds like it minimizes potential.
Right.
My question was just more in terms of how these things were laid down. Is it always the Buddha being very explicit about saying that this is a rule of the Sangha, or is it like if something happened and they have a bit of a teaching and people interpret it as potentially applying to like a Vinaya context? Does that happen, or is it always an explicit rule?
Okay, so in the Vinaya, it's always explicit. So there'll be some kind of background context or something, and then the Buddha will lay down a rule. Yeah. Of course, there's always grey areas, so there's always a lot of interpretation and so on around that. And then that's where the more general principles of the Dhamma come in. Yeah. But yes, the Vinaya always lays down the rule explicitly. Yeah. Sing Sing.
You mentioned earlier that the preceptor remains mentor for life.
Yes.
So what happens if the mentor dies, disrobes, does the student have to get another mentor?
No. Yeah. So if one of the things we go on there to talk about is the period of dependence, so it's a typically five-year period. So when the student ordains, they go under dependence for 5 years, which basically means normally originally that would mean that they live with their preceptor for 5 years, and then after that, if the preceptor feels that they're qualified, then they're allowed to go travelling and stay in different places and so on. If the preceptor dies or disrobes in that period, then normally they would take another teacher so that they can take an acharya. So acharya is a teacher who has basically the same role as the mentor, but is temporary. Right? So typically if you're still a junior monastic, you go and stay in a new monastery, then you would take, like if I was ordained for 2 years and I went to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery, I would take Ajahn Brahma as my acharya. And you do a formal procedure where you actually ask him, can you please be my acharya? And then you would do that until for that period of dependence. Yeah. But then that would cease when I left that monastery, which is the difference from the mentor. Yeah. Yeah.
So can the mentor have multiple students?
Yes, mentor can have multiple students. Yeah. Typically, these days, they will often have many because the like I said before, the role is essentially state-appointed, certainly in Thailand. So that the purpose of that is to restrict those who are doing ordination so they can control the sangha. This was introduced in the late 19th century in Thailand. So in that case, the preceptors typically have many students and usually don't even know who they are. They just come through and they just do the rituals and so on. So, yeah. It really is quite different. Yeah. Okay.
But you mentioned there's not about 5 years.
Yes. What is that about? 5 years basically is like a graduate program or like an undergrad program. Yeah, so you normally will stay with your upajaya for 5 years, okay? Or if you go stay somewhere else, then you will go and stay somewhere with an acharya, usually who's recommended by your upajaya. So again, let's say I was going to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery, and then Ajahn Brahm, I ordained there, Ajahn Brahm was my upajaya, and then after 2 or 3 years I wanted to, let's say, go to Sri Lanka and stay there, then Ajahn Brahm would say yes, but he would want to know where I'm going, and he would want to know who the acharya is there at the monastery I'm staying. So if you're going to a good monastery with a good acharya, then usually that's fine. Yeah, Hemia.
So you said like there was no commandment, right? Like,
right.
But then I've also heard that like there are certain rules, like 4 or something, that
right.
If a monk does, then they will lose the...
That's
monk.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, how does that happen? Like, in sense, like, if there's no commandment,
if there's no commandment, it's the Vinaya that makes a decision and the Sangha that understands the Vinaya. So you're talking about the 4 Parajika rules?
Yeah.
So if you do if you commit one of the 4 Parajika rules, then you're out. You're immediately no longer a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni, and you can never reordain again. And actually talks about those later in that same chapter, in fact. But that's according to the proceeding of the Vinaya, right? The Vinaya, the ruling is laid down by the Vinaya and then enforced by the Sangha, but not by an individual monk. So no individual monk can then say to you, you're Parajika, get out, right? You become Parajika because of your deeds, and the Sangha recognizes that as a whole. Okay? Yeah.
So, somebody who has committed Parajika, they
yes.
have to confess to it.
Right.
But what if they don't confess?
Right?
Like, let's say they have committed the wrong.
So, okay, fine. So which Parajika would you be thinking of committing, Cynthia? No, but if you were, which one would you think would be fun?
Breaking the rules.
Right, so having sex, right? So which one would you choose? Out of those, which one would you choose? Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there have been cases, you know. Okay, falsely claiming to be enlightened. Okay, so if you actually, I don't know if you could do that since, I mean, if you actually are enlightened, you can't break that rule. I've known you for many years since then. I'm not ruling anything out. Okay, that's what I'm saying. I don't know. But let's say that you're not enlightened, then you falsely claim that you are enlightened. It's just like that example I gave beforehand. Right? You say, oh, you know, it's a much merit to give to a greatly enlightened sage such as myself, this kind of thing. Then people complain about it and they bring it to the Sangha, and then the Sangha confronts you, say, is this true? And then if you deny it, right, if you're lying about it, then that puts everybody in a difficult situation, right? If you admit to it, then you're out, right? If you lie about it, hard to say what to do exactly, right? So in practice, usually the Sangha would ask you to leave the monastery and you basically be kicked out and so on, but it's difficult to prosecute the Vinaya when the individual denies it. Normally, for almost every rule, the Vinaya requires that the individual concerned actually confesses. The only exception to that is if a monk is accused by a laywoman of sexual harassment or sexual abuse. In that case, the word of the laywoman alone is sufficient for the monk to be held guilty. Right? That's a specific exception. Every other case, the monk is required to confess. If everybody's witnessed it, look, in that case, if everybody's witnessed it, everyone, you're going to kick him out and you're going to act like they're Parajika anyway, but you can't really do anything more than that, unfortunately. Yeah, like you can talk to other people in other monasteries so the Sangha would, you know, normally know. I mean, there are procedures for kicking monastics out if they refuse to admit an offence. So that's another whole section of Vinaya. So if somebody refuses to see the offence, then there's a procedure you go to. Yeah, but ultimately there are limits on what you can do, which is why in Buddhist countries that then tends to go to the secular authorities. Yeah, and the cops will arrest you and put you in jail and take your robes off you. Yeah. A sangha is usually the community within a monastery. Technically it's a community within a sīma, within a monastic boundary. So whoever's gathered within that monastic boundary, which is usually a monastery. Yeah.
It's the woman who went against it.
Uh-huh.
How can you prove
it? Okay, so you're asking about the accusations of sexual misconduct.
Yeah.
So the rule says a sadhaya vacha sahubhasika, which means a trustworthy laywoman. Okay, so if a trustworthy laywoman makes an accusation against a monk, then you should believe her and you should go, you should follow that. Yeah.
What if a man makes that comment?
Yeah, bad luck. This is one of those rules that specifically only applies if a trustworthy laywoman makes the complaint. There's no equivalent rule for the bhikkhunis. It's not that. And just to say, in modern studies of this, when they're looking at accusations of rape by women, the studies typically find that false accusations of rape is about 3%. Okay, false convictions for homicide is about 5 to 7%. Okay, so you're twice as likely to be falsely convicted by a judge and jury than you are to face a false accusation of rape by a single woman. Yeah, just so we're clear about how this happens. And there are obviously many reasons why that's the case, but typically because any woman who makes that accusation is then going to suffer even more than they did with the original offence. So, yeah. Please, yes. Okay. So the question is, in a country, is there a register of all of the monks who are ordained? In some places, yes. So in Thailand, I mentioned before that the preceptor's role was to fill out the forms. So that's what they do. So they actually fill out the forms. You get a document, which is like an internal passport. And that's supposed to give you an ID to identify yourself as a monk. These are very funny documents because they have to do the photos of them before you're ordained, but you can't wear your robe before you're ordained, right? Then you'd be impersonating a monk. So what they do is they get one of those, they get like a fake plastic thing that vaguely looks like a robe that you have to stand behind and get your photo taken so that you kind of look like you're a monk. And then that's in your monk's passport forever. So in my experience in Thailand, I was never asked for that. I actually lost my passport. I lost my wallet some years ago and I never got it back again. But technically you're supposed to do that. And so, yes, in Thailand, because the Sangha is governed by an act of parliament in Thailand, so all of that is actually registered under government authority. But it's different in different places. So within, say, in Sri Lanka, they don't have the same system. So in Sri Lanka, I imagine that those lists would be maintained by each Nikaya. So when they did the ordination, they'd note who was ordained, and that would be maintained by the Siam Nikaya or by the Amarapura Nikaya. Yeah.
So the way it works in Thailand seems to defeat the purpose of the Sangha that the established.
I think in many ways, yeah. And that system that was used in Thailand was very strongly resisted by the Sangha when it was introduced, especially by the Sangha in the north of Thailand. So, you know, these days people take it for granted, but it really, I think it really shouldn't be. Yeah. It ends up being that being a preceptor is very lucrative. You can make a lot of money from it. So then there's a lot of competition to become a preceptor. Right? How do you make money? When the ordinations happen, people, the families will give you money to the preceptor. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of donations, a lot of staff, a lot of prestige. So yeah, I agree. I think it's become very corrupted. That system should be abolished and the system should be in line with the Vinaya. Yeah. Sangha should appoint preceptors. Okay, we should finish up. Thanks, everybody. Look, I've got some bad news for you. This is going to be the last talk that I will give tonight. But I will be giving more talks in the future, okay? So don't worry about that too much. I'm off. I'm sorry. I'm going to Indonesia tomorrow. So if you're in Indonesia, got any friends there, then check out your Ehi Pasiko and hopefully you can see you there. And Venerable Pasana, good news, he's going to be here next week. Sadhu, sadhu. Iopeka, Venerable Pasana just said good news is I will be there next week.
Nice.
We're going to work that out. Either Venerable Pasana or Venerable Iopeka will be here next week. Looks like Venerable. Okay, so so next week, and yeah, but the talks in Parramatta at the library in Parramatta Square will still be on at 6 p.m. and here at 7, and I'll be back sooner than you imagine. I'll be back. More or less, yeah, I think I'm back on Monday week, yeah. So I'll be going around Indonesia entertaining the good folks of Indonesia. They'll be entertaining me, actually. Yeah. Is there anything else? Nilushi, did you have something to announce? Okay. So thanks, everybody. For coming, thanks for sharing this time, and hopefully we can all continue to grow in our practice, and I'll see you back here in a couple of weeks.